Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. At the end of the invasion of Iraq, President George Bush, in military helmet and jumpsuit, landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln with the banner Mission Accomplished in red, white, and blue behind him. That image of Bush as shining warrior has taken some hits as the war on terrorism continues and as Democrat John Kerry dusts off his silver and bronze stars and purple hearts for real combat service in Vietnam. The commander-in-chief is now forced to defend his own military war record years ago in the Texas Air National Guard. First came allegations of Bush as a no-show, then intimations of a cover-up. Republicans charge it's all politics and posturing. Reporters are still digging. And Americans are left to decide how much it all matters. Tonight on Point, the uproar over President Bush's Air National Guard service. Does the president's Vietnam-era military record matter to you now? Do you smell a cover-up, a hatchet job, an old truth revealed? How do you weigh this history in the face of war in Iraq, war on terror? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Boston is Walter Robinson, assistant managing editor of the Boston Globe. He's editor of the Globe's investigative team, and in May 2000 began reporting on the alleged one-year gap in George Bush's Air National Guard service. Good evening and welcome, Walter Robinson.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
It's great to have you with us, Walter.
Thanks.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Robinson.
Hey, Jack. How are you?
Good.
Walter Robinson, you've been on this a long time, and you were early on it. There's a lot we want to know from you, but take us back for just a moment to the year 2000. Why did this come out? Where did this come from?
Well, we got our hands on a substantial portion of then-Governor Bush's military records, about 160 pages. And once we looked through them, deciphered them, and translated them, it became apparent that for 1 year within his service, between mid-1972 and mid-1973, there was no record that he did any duty at all.
And this is within a 5.5 year term of service.
That's correct. He entered in May of 68, and as you know, this has been well documented, he got some help, some advantage, because his father was a congressman at the time, and some calls were made to get him into the Guard.
12 days before he would have lost his college deferment.
That's correct.
This didn't exactly bring him down in 2000. He became president.
Well, that's correct. I mean, first of all, the national security was not a big issue mm-hmm. at the time. He was, after all, running to replace a president who, to put it charitably, had taken some active steps to avoid any military service at all.
That would be Bill Clinton.
That would mm-hmm. be Bill Clinton. And Al Gore, I think many people thought, didn't have the credibility to raise a question about Bush's credibility on an issue like this.
So now it's John Kerry as the Democratic frontrunner, famously a war combat hero in Vietnam, lots of medals, and it's back. It's been put in play by Democrats, not least. I mean, the head of the Democratic Party and, you know, Michael Moore and others started making a lot of noise about it. Reporters have continued digging. In this latest round, Walter Robinson, what have we learned? What's new in this latest round of digging?
Well, what we have learned is surprisingly, the Bush campaign, which scrubbed all of his records, I don't mean that in a negative sense, but they had all of his records in during the last campaign. They didn't have them all. It turns out that there were records in Colorado, which now show that he did some duty, though it was sporadic, during that 1 year between 1972 and 1973. The problem with the appearance of these records is that you can't tell where he did the duty, whether it was in Alabama, where he was part of the time, or in Houston, which was his home base. And the fact that there's now some evidence he did duty contradicts other documents in his records from his own commanders, one of whom was his friend, saying they couldn't perform his evaluation in May of 73 because they hadn't seen him for, during the prior 12 months.
So where's this headed, Walter? We've seen pay records. We've seen dental records. Is there still, I guess there's two faces to this at least, but one is whether or not he served the time properly. Do the records that the administration has put out so far answer that question? And secondly, this issue of whether there's something being revealed, or concealed, covered up, even destroyed in the records. How do you see those two legs here?
Well, I think that, well, I mean, the records clearly, as we know them, show that the son of somebody of privilege got into a unit and got tired of it and didn't work very hard at it, and they let him out. What we remember that the president on Sunday on Meet the Press promised, at least as I heard it and most other people, to release all of his military records.
Talking with Tim Russert, that was fairly clear on Sunday.
Well, it's no longer clear. The White House has now determined that what the president really said is that he would release any records that relate to the question of his attendance at drills. So what that means is that if there are records that explain why he did not take his flight physical in 1972, mm-hmm. why he was then taken formally removed from flight status, why he did not return to the flight line, if there are any records about that sort of thing, we may not get them. Along with other reporters, we've asked the White House to reconsider that and make all the records public. If there's nothing embarrassing in the records, they ought to make them all public.
And what about this report we read today about a former, what is it, Colonel Burkett?
That's right.
Who says that he witnessed, well, you tell us, he witnessed officers in Texas destroying records related to George Bush's service. Have I got that right, Walter Robinson?
That's essentially correct. And Michael Resendez of our staff will have a story about that tomorrow, but I would caution you to not to necessarily place full faith in that report.
Okay, we'll watch that one closely. But Walter, you're a longtime investigative reporter. You're a vet yourself. You've watched presidential politics closely for a long time. In your eye, where's the cutting edge here? Where's the beef? Where does the rubber hit the road? Where does this whole flap matter?
Well, you know, national security is obviously a major issue in this election, and the so-called veterans vote, I suppose, is important to both candidates, assuming, and reporters who assume results in elections are often found to be wrong, but assuming that Senator Kerry is a Democratic nominee, this is an issue that the Democrats would clearly like to use to allow or to prevent President Bush from, to quote Max Cleland, wrapping himself in the flag.
Is it a credible issue in your mind?
That's not for me to decide, Tom. My job is to dig up the information. I think, as a reporter, that biography is important. It's important in assessing the character of a leader, whether and on the other side of the coin, of course, people have made the point, as well they should, that Senator Kerry defended Bill Clinton's decisions not to do military service.
Mm-hmm.
And there are those who will criticize Senator Kerry for coming back from Vietnam and the time he spent in the anti-war movement. There are some veterans who feel undermined by that. So I think one of the things that's going on here politically is that the Democrats have been test marketing this issue. You know, the Democrats are, if they're likely to have another nominee who's a liberal from the Northeast, from Massachusetts, are going to do their very best to try to inoculate their candidate against the kinds of attacks that undermined Michael Dukakis in 1988.
Let me ask you this, Walter. You've got a lot of history as an investigative reporter. Is there a cover-up here?
I can't say there's any evidence of one. All I can say is that if there are other records, they ought to be made public. I believe there are some other records. They may not be embarrassing, but I think the public has a right right to know. And if the White House wants the issue to go away, then they ought to get everything out there.
And at this point, you don't think it's out there. Do you think they have access to more than they're showing?
Well, the Pentagon now has all of the files related to President Bush, including his medical records, any administrative records, and everything else. And the White House is vetting those, whatever has come into the Pentagon, and making decision on what to make public. And their view now is that they have a limited responsibility to the public, despite what the president said on Sunday.
And just to be very clear, because this is being debated, after everything you've looked at and investigated, is it your view that the president did not properly complete his Air National Guard service in 72, 73?
Well, even though the White House said that he met the bare minimum requirements for so-called retirement purposes, he actually fell in that year, assuming he actually did drills on all the days that are now listed. He fell 2 weeks short of what the minimum that is expected for training. All guardsmen are expected to do 1 weekend a month, that's 24 days, plus 15 days of annual active duty. And in that 1 year, President Bush fell pretty well short of that, and that was even with a rush to do a lot of days in the last month of May of 73. So he didn't fulfill his commitment that year, but he was on his way out, and his commanders were, and there may have been a cost-benefit analysis done there that he was not interested in staying. They were about to transition to a new aircraft, though they had not yet. And maybe it was wiser to let him go and go off to the Harvard Business School. They had a lot of Vietnam combat veteran pilots who wanted to get into the Air Guard units. And so there was a replacement for him.
And off he went. Walter Robinson, we'll keep reading. Please keep digging. And thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Happy to help.
Walter V. Robinson, editor of the Spotlight Team, the Boston Globe's investigative unit. He's been following the story of President Bush's military service since the year 2000. Jack Beatty, what are you reading in this story right now? Walter boils it down to 2 weeks missing. Is that a big deal? Should that bring down a president?
No, not at all. But nothing is fair in politics. This is an issue because we're talking about it. Every speech that he makes, John Kerry is introduced by Max Cleland. Max Cleland, I watched him the other night on this. His face gets red as he talks about it. He's a man who lost three limbs in Vietnam and who was done out of his Senate seat by ads from the Republicans morphing him into Osama bin Laden. He's plenty mad against Bush, and he's not going to let this drop. But three things combine here for the president: the context, his credibility, and the opposing candidate. The opposing candidate, Kerry, makes this salient just by who he is. The context, President Bush's decision, now we know, based on false or misleading or however you want to call it, information, has led to the death of 550 Americans and counting, and the wounding of thousands more. It intimately connects with his own service history in a way that isn't logical, but is just there in the atmospherics. And thirdly, credibility. The president is really in trouble on credibility. The latest CNN poll finds him only 44% say he's a leader you can trust. 55 say they have some doubts and reservations. Among independents, only 38% trust him. 61% have doubts and reservations. And, of course, he was using his trust to insulate himself from his poor policy results, the violence in Iraq, the jobless recovery, the skyrocketing budget deficit. Now that credibility is under threat for the weapons of mass destruction and now for his claims about his own past history.
So you see this as one more piece on the pile. Do you expect this to grow during the campaign season, Jack, or are we seeing the high point right now? Is this an issue with legs, to your mind?
Well, some people think that it was ill-timed of the Democrats to bring it up now. I've seen pieces saying, oh, gee, if they could only have held this to the fall. But these issues emerge, and I think that there's some signaling going on. They're trying to tell the president this is going to be a no-holds-barred campaign. John Kerry is not Michael Dukakis.
Well, both sides can play that game, and very well might. We're talking tonight about the uproar over President Bush's Vietnam-era Air National Guard service, the merits of the allegations that he was missing releasing from duty, and how the flap may play out in the presidential campaign. Does President Bush's Vietnam-era military record matter to you? Should it be a campaign issue, or is it unfair? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the uproar over President Bush's Vietnam-era Air National Guard service. You can join our conversation tonight. Is all this only coming up because Democrat John Kerry has that chest full of medals? Is President Bush's credibility now an issue with you, or are you solid behind the commander in chief? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Austin, Texas, by James Moore, co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and of the forthcoming book, Bush's War for Re-election. Good evening and welcome, James Moore.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. And we're joined from Los Angeles by Alan Hoffenblum. He's a Republican political strategist and decorated Vietnam War veteran. He's publisher of the California Target Book, an election guidebook of key races for Congress and the state legislature. Good evening and welcome, Alan Hoffenblum.
Ah, welcome from sunny California.
It's good to have you. Alan, I'm sure you're watching this whole debate. You were in Vietnam. You've got that perspective as well, and you've got a GOP perspective. How do you see this? Does President Bush have something to answer for, or do we have a case blown out of proportion? What's your reading?
Well, let me speak as a Vietnam veteran. I was back in Vietnam twice, first in 1965, then I went back in 1967, 68. And my last 8 months in Vietnam was down in the Mekong Delta. It was very interesting. I was aware of Senator Kerry's war record and his heroism, but until I did some investigation, I didn't know exactly what he did and where he was in Vietnam. And it appears that he was a patrol boat captain at a base just down the street from the air base in which I served.
Not far from where you were.
And not at the same time, by the way. I think it was there later than I. But I know the base. In fact, I took a tour on one of those river boats, and I'm telling you, I was scared to death. The full time I was on it. It was an extraordinarily dangerous job, one of the most dangerous in the military, by the way. And there's no doubt that John Kerry was a great and outstanding military officer. My decoration was for the Bronze Star was for a meritorious service, and I know the difference between heroism and meritorious service. But I was there. Now. Since I know it's going to be on the show, I decided to do some research about and give you some numbers that's very interesting. During the entire Vietnam War era, 8,744,000 Americans served in the military during that period of time, of which 2.7 million actually served in Vietnam, meaning over 70% of the people who were in the American military during the Vietnam War never put one foot, into the country called Vietnam.
Well, of course, in different years, there were very different ratios of people going. We had some very heavy populations there and much lighter ones early on, right?
That is correct. When I was first there, was only 35,000 GIs. When I left, there were 270,000 GIs. But the point I'm making is, of those during the Vietnam War, over 70% who served in the American military were patriots. They served their country. They're served the country well, but were not asked by the military or the government to actually go to Vietnam.
But they're not all president. They're not all commander-in-chief. They haven't all led the country to a major war. And they don't all have this issue in the press floating up against them that they were, not on duty when they should have been.
Hey, listen, let's all get behind John McCain and make him president of the United States. No president since Vietnam has actually served in Vietnam. And by the way, as one who served in Vietnam, I know many veterans. There's a lot of Vietnam veterans. I would no way vote to become president of the United States. And I think any of the gentlemen who spoke before me would vote for me to be president of the United States just because I happened to serve in Vietnam, at the time. What I'm saying is if John Kerry gets the vote for every Vietnam veteran, he'll end up getting about, 2 million votes. If George W. Bush gets everyone who served in the war during the war in Vietnam who did not go to Vietnam, he'll get over close to 9 million votes. So I just think it's ridiculous. This issue. The difference with those of us who served in Vietnam, where we really know the difference, is between those who serve their country, regardless whether it's at a desk at Fort Ord or as a training officer, here in the United States, or they went to Vietnam, or somebody who went to Canada, or somebody like Howard Dean who found out he had a bad back and got a deferment to go to medical school, or someone like Bill Clinton who did everything he could to prevent himself. That we differentiate between those who served their country during the war in Vietnam and those who did everything they could not. George W. Bush, in fact, served in the military, as many people did in the National Guard during this period of time.
So it's not flying for you as an issue. James Moore, how do you see it?
Well, I disagree completely with Alan, though I have great respect for his service to our country, and I've interviewed him a number of times as a political analyst, and he's an extremely astute and intelligent man, but we disagree amazingly on this particular issue. I think that this question of whether the president served out his time and lived up to his sworn oath to do his duty and defend our country, even if it was just stateside of the National Guard, goes to the heart of his moral authority as president, as a guy who's going to send our sons and daughters into the midst of bombs and bullets over in Iraq. Remember, if this had happened, if people had taken President Bush's attitude in our current National Guard, the young men and women who have been called up, if they had been as capricious about their oath to the country and had disappeared for 3 or 6 months at a time and then not been there when the country needed them to go fight the war on terrorism that George Bush sent them to fight, where would our country be in the war on terrorism? How would we be able to defend ourselves in Iraq? George W. Bush shirked his duty. He disappeared. There is to this day not a single soul, not a person in Alabama, not a person in Texas who has ever come forward to say, I did weekend drills or I did summer camp with a guy who became the president of the United States of America.
And what about this officer in Texas, Bill Burkett? And he's being quoted today saying that he overheard stories of the president's files being set aside, destroyed. I'm not sure.
Well, no, these are being reported in my new book, that Bush's War for Reelection book. And let me explain. He is a colonel who is brought in to help the Texas National Guard improve its force readiness. He walked into the commander's office at a time when the phone was ringing to ask the general a question. The general said, hang on, I have to take this call. He punched it onto speakerphone. It was Joe Albaugh, the chief of staff of the governor at that time. And Albaugh said, General, we need you to take a look at the governor's files, clean them up, and remove any embarrassments because we're going to write a book in case the governor wants to run for a higher office. The same thing occurred the next morning when Colonel Burkett was standing next to a coffee machine with the general and another general, Wayne Marty, and the same orders were issued. Take a look at those files, remove the embarrassments. We want our guy to put his best foot forward.
And this is General Daniel James, who was head of the Texas Air National Guard?
And is now the head of the National Guard Bureau in Washington, as head of the U.S. Air National Guard.
Who named him to this new position?
He moved into this new position when George W. Bush became president.
Big promotion.
Yes. And so 1 week later, Bill Burkett is doing an evening walk with another colonel, and he ends up in the Texas State National Guard Museum. And inside of that museum is General John Scribner, who has George Bush's military personnel records jacket in front of him, folded open in a gray metal waste can next to him, and is sorting through it and dropping documents into the waste can. And in the waste can, Colonel Burkett said he saw retirements documents and pay documents, total points documents, all of the documents that those of us who are journalists presently find missing today. Take what we know about Karl Rove as an operative and the way he handles things. Take what we know about George Bush's spotty record that's been released presently and put all these pieces together, and we have a story that deserves some scrutiny. I believe George Bush disappeared. He was not held accountable because it would have been an embarrassment to his family and to the people who led him into the Guard with privilege. And now it's been tried to cover up. They began this lie more than 10 years ago when I was a journalist, and I asked him this question in a televised debate for governor in 1994. I think that we have a cover-up, and I think that it has finally caught up with the president of the United States.
It sounds like we haven't heard the end of it, though. Walter Robinson with the Boston Globe saying tonight that they're still reporting this Burkett thing, and he's not sure that there's as much there as, well, let's say it may be in some dispute, but we'll watch it unfold. Alan Hoffenblum, these are more serious kind of allegations. I mean, once you get into cover-up, they have the sound of the kind of thing that can really trip a president up.
Oh, everything's a cover-up, isn't it? I mean, everything that comes up. But there's a lot of balderdash there. First of all, when you go back to the war in Vietnam vis-a-vis the National Guard, remember, we had military draft back then. The way the Army was able to make sure there were sufficient soldiers to be sent to Vietnam, they drafted them. We don't have a draft here in the war on terrorism, the war on Iraq and Afghanistan.
So?
That's why the National Guard, by the way, if you don't want to be sent overseas, don't join the National Guard at this time, because it's not the same as it was back in the war in Vietnam. But also you got to remember, I was at a base, I told you, been to a, not far from where
Mekong Delta,
Kerry,
yeah.
In the Mekong Delta. But you know what? That was 35 years ago. If you force me to ask me who the name of my base commander was, I hammered the foggiest idea. I had a young airman who was my executive assistant, you know, on the intelligence shop that I had there on the base. You asked me what his name is. I don't remember whatsoever. I had numerous people that I knew there when I was in Vietnam. Today, I would be an enormously difficult time. Remember, did I know what their names were?
But you weren't the son of a prominent
and all that type of stuff, because it's so long ago.
But you weren't the son of a prominent congressman. You weren't photographed with your son and base commanders when he came into the service. I mean, this George Bush was a little different than your average draftee.
I don't know whether George Bush was that much different. I mean, congressman, son of a congressman. I mean, I'm sure I ran into, you know, VIP type people when I was in Vietnam, but. But what I'm telling you is you don't remember whether or not you showed up on Tuesday, January 2nd, you know, to do a training mission. It was George W. Bush there at the same time.
Yep.
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's silly. But let's be honest what the real issue is. Now, I've told, again, I see the gentleman attacking George W. Bush as commander-in-chief. The decisions he made before 9/11, after 9/11, and the decisions he's making now, that is legitimate debate. That is what the people ultimately are going to decide come, you know, the first Tuesday, November. Is George W. Bush now, as the commander-in-chief, as our president of the United States, is he up to the job and he's doing the job? Going back to find out whether or not he missed 2 weeks in the Alabama National Guard, there's going to be so many issues of so much more importance between now and November 2nd. I think this by now will long ago be forgotten.
You don't think this one's going to be a big deal? Let's see what our callers think. Michael is calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. Well, you know, it's interesting. I've been listening for the last 20 minutes, and a lot of my comments have been echoed both by Alan and even Walter earlier. I really respect the man for how they're approaching it. And his caution, or his cautious view, rather, really should be something the Democrats kind of follow, because I've left politics for some time. I was political director for GOPAC, which Alan probably knows was Newt Gingrich's kind of independent political arm.
Remember it well.
And I entered into politics very young when Newt took down Speaker Wright. And so I understand some of the mudslinging. And I really think that the Democrats putting too much weight into this issue is not a smart move.
Why not? Why not, Michael?
Well, the main reason is there really aren't legs to it. I think they want legs to be there. But the truth is, and we saw this so much with Bill Clinton, that even major issues of moral and ethical character that are far severe than missing 2 weeks of potential training didn't really have an impact in the voters' mind. And I think the Democrats, and I don't know why I'm advising them here, but I'm unhappy with Bush's war decisions. And Alan really stated it perfectly. There's a lot bigger issues that they need to be talking about, because if they put too much into this, it's going to backfire, because people are going to just think it's mudslinging. And it's slipping that way very fast because they're so desperate to take down Bush. And they're really passionate about it. It's unbelievable.
No question about it. And there's a lot of raw material here. Whatever it adds up to, with your Newt Gingrich background, you know something of what you speak. Michael, thanks very much for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack, here we are with, you know, on the one hand, James Moore saying we've got a problem with moral authority in the president, presenting the president as a kind of poser in the context of war. On the other hand, Alan Hoffenblum says, look at the politics, look at the numbers here. This just doesn't add up. This is not going to take the president down.
I don't think it will, no question about it. But, you know, now it is a press hunt. Now the press is on this, and this story about Mr. Burkett, this is going to be investigated even further. And, again, it just adds a layer to this credibility problem that's haunting the president. MoveOn.org, a very hostile anti-Bush group with access to a lot of money, is about to put an ad up called Polygraph. And in this ad, Bush will be saying things he said about Saddam and Iraq that were not true. And you just see a polygraph machine. And at the end, the commercial ends with someone saying, Americans are dying for the truth, appears on the screen. And this adds yet another log to that fire.
On the credibility front, Jim is calling from East Dubuque, Illinois. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. I think this is a question of hypocrisy and integrity from a guy who got into office by pretending to be more honest or have more integrity. And what seems interesting to me is that, you know, when he was suspended and grounded for not taking a medical exam, and it was coincidentally about the time they began random drug testing the same month. Normally you'd have a flight inquiry board to decide a question like that, and I'm wondering why those kind of records, if there was such a committee, might be being withheld.
Well, it seems like there's a number of things that still aren't in the public eye, but we'll pick it up. Jim, thanks very much for your call. James Moore, is there more to come out here, or have we got most of it at this point?
Well, we haven't gotten all of it because we haven't seen all of the records, and all of the records will show whether the president served the minimum number of days. We have what's missing is an inquiry, an officer or commander's board of inquiry on the grounding of George W. Bush as a pilot. He failed to take his flight exam. He was grounded. There is a requirement that there be a formal investigation convened as to why a pilot is grounded after $1 million is spent teaching him to fly an aircraft. That's always been missing from his file. The pay stubs, which show the actual days he did duty, mm-hmm. are missing from his file. Anything related to his medical file, there have been rumors that have swirled around the president about his use of substances and alcohol, and that any medical files are also missing. And what's called the administrative roll-up of total points is missing from this file. When we get a chance to see all those files, which, by the way, the president has not signed an authorization signature to send to the National Personnel Records Center in Denver, yep. or the Air Reserve Personnel Center, that's in Denver, and the other one in St. Louis. He hasn't authorized the release of those total files, which are on microfiche. His retained records file, the hard copy file, which is at the National Guard offices in Austin, is the one that reporters have been poring over. If everything that was on the microfiche in St. Louis and Denver were printed out and delivered to reporters without the White House looking at it first and vetting it, then we would know the truth.
Something like the whole story. Ellen Hoffenblum, we've just got a minute left. Our caller poses two big issues, credibility above all, and as Jack's alluding to, and the issue of integrity. George Bush ran on it, presenting himself as a cut above. Does that make all of this add up to erosion on the credibility front?
Now, only time will tell. My personal opinion, again, I wish the world was safe enough and the issues in the upcoming election were so benign enough that we could really spend the next few months talking about whether or not George W. Bush spent 2 weeks in the Alabama Air National Guard and he take a physical on time and things are such. The bottom line is, you know, I want to finish my remarks, you know, going back. I was looking at an article here in 1992 when another Senator Kerry, by the name of Bob Kerry in Nebraska, who lost a leg in Vietnam, was trying to make an issue of Bill Clinton and his so-called record during the war in Vietnam. And let me quote him.
Quickly, we're almost out of time.
We do not need to divide America over who served and how. John Kerry was correct then, and he would be correct now to repeat those words.
Ellen Hoffenblum, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Republican political strategist Ellen Hoffenblum and James Moore, author of the forthcoming Bush's War for Re-Election. Thank you for being with us from Austin, Texas tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jack, thanks for being on board.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. After the break, a look at Pakistan's illicit nuclear trading network. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yesterday, as Pakistan's trade in nuclear weapons technology continued to make front page news, President Bush proposed new measures to address the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Here's a short excerpt of his speech at the National Defense University in Washington.
The best intelligence is necessary to win the war on terror and to stop proliferation. So that is why I have established a commission that will examine our intelligence capabilities and recommend ways to improve and adapt them to detect new and emerging threats. We're determined to confront those threats at the source. We will stop these weapons from being acquired or built. We'll block them from being transferred. We will prevent them from ever being used.
President Bush speaking yesterday at the National Defense University at Fort McNair in Washington, D.C. The president's speech came 1 week after the White House expressed support for Pakistan's presidential pardon of A.Q. Khan, the so-called father of that nation's nuclear program. Khan admitted to selling weapons technology to other countries, including Iran, Libya, and North Korea. The scope of Khan's network and the complicity of the Pakistani government is still not fully known. David Sanger has been covering the story for the New York Times. I asked him when American intelligence got its first break in its investigation of A.Q. Khan.
Well, the big break, Tom, came in Malaysia, of all places, about as far from Pakistan and the United States as you can get, in a factory that the Khan network had contracted with to build centrifuge parts. Centrifuges are, of course, the high-speed tubes that you use to enrich uranium and thus make bomb fuel. And it's not clear that the factory knew what these were going to be used for, but the factory itself had been penetrated by intelligence agencies. They followed the shipment as it went from Malaysia to Dubai, where it was relabeled as used machinery.
So this is last August,
this
the CIA tracking,
August,
they saw the container ships in the Straits of Malacca, and they began tracking them by satellite. They knew they had...
out through, Tom, to our old territory, the Straits of Malacca, and then down to Dubai. They were tracking it by satellite. Then it arrives in Dubai. It gets transferred to another ship called the BBC China. It's put in five containers and sent on its way to Libya. And about the time it made it through the Suez Canal, the order went out to have it seized, at which point German intelligence was brought in, contacted the German owner of the ship, which didn't really know what it was carrying.
Yeah.
They agreed to divert the ship to a port in Italy, and there they took apart the containers and, sure enough, found centrifuge parts, thousands of them.
That is the very elements of a nuclear weapons program, not very far at that point from Libya. The story, as you tell it, continues to unfold from there, where they're found weapons blueprints wrapped in bags from an Islamabad dry cleaner, the fingerprints of A.Q. Khan and Pakistani science all over this shadowy global network of black market nuclear weapons information and technology.
What's the matter, Tom? When you pick up your dry cleaning, you don't usually get weapons designs in with it?
It doesn't normally come with a free nuclear bomb diagram.
Right.
I guess the question is, how did this go on for so long? You describe A.Q. Khan having first stolen centrifuge designs for Pakistan to develop its first bomb all the way back in 1976 from a lab in Europe where he was working. But by the 1980s, as you describe it, he was over-ordering all kinds of nuclear parts. Why did it take so long for this network to become public, for it to have everybody's hair on fire?
It's interesting because it happened gradually. I mean, by the late 1980s, American intelligence was certainly aware of Khan and believed that he may have been trading in missile technology, not necessarily in nuclear technology. In the 90s, we all certainly heard a bit about him, people who covered this kind of thing, but the evidence was always sort of scarce. The big change, at least for us here at the Times, came after the discovery in October of 2002 that North Korea had obtained a uranium bomb technology, and they were using this to try to cheat on an agreement that froze another nuclear program, another nuclear weapons program, that an agreement that had reached in 1994 with the United States.
Right.
And as we did that investigation, it turned out that, in fact, the North Koreans had gone to Pakistan, or at least to Dr. Khan, and obtained this additional design in return, we believe, for missile technology. Now, we had an interview earlier this week with President Musharraf of Pakistan, who said, oh, no, you guys got that wrong. We didn't actually get those missiles in return for the nuclear program. Mm. We paid the North Koreans $200 million for the missiles. Now, in that particular case, you could argue that North Korea could then take the money and put it into their nuclear program, which has been absorbing a vast amount of their budget. But either way, what you have is an exchange with North Korea in which we had nuclear technology flowing north to North Korea and missile technology flowing south to Pakistan.
So at this point, Dr. Khan has made a public confession of all this. He's been pardoned by General Musharraf. But still, the full dimensions of this network don't seem to be on the table necessarily.
Oh, no. I don't think we know 10% of what went on, Tom.
What were Dr. Khan's motives for spreading nuclear weapons around the world?
Well, I think you could identify three.
The first is that in his writings, he has always been extraordinarily critical of what he's called the so-called secrecy of the Western nations, which is to say that he was unhappy with the fact that the United States and the other Western nations felt that they had a monopoly on nuclear weapons technology. Mm. Secondly, he argued that there was no crime in spreading bomb technology around other Islamic nations because without that, they would never have parity with non-Islamic states.
Mm-hmm.
Although many people believe that, in fact, that argument was a show and that it was popular within Pakistan and perhaps among some of the people he worked with, but that, in fact, while he's a fierce nationalist, he's not really an Islamic extremist in any form. The third motive, shocking as it may be, would be money, that he managed to take a network that he had built up to import nuclear parts into Pakistan when he was working on Pakistan's own secret nuclear weapons program and reverse the flow and suddenly realized that there were tens of millions of dollars to be made by selling full packages that include factory designs, centrifuge designs, and in the case of Libya, bomb designs.
Which he proceeded precisely to do. And at this point, A.Q. Khan appears to be a wealthy man. He owns homes and properties and a tourist hotel in Africa. David, when you say that at this point we don't know 10% of the story, does that mean that more nations beyond North Korea, Iran, Libya may have nuclear weapons or nuclear weapons technology and plans at this time, that there are more dry cleaner bags floating around the world for anybody to buy?
Well, if you come across a copied set of nuclear designs and you come across centrifuge designs in three different nations, Iran, North Korea, and Libya, there's really no reason to believe that in the great wide world, those would be the only three countries he would sell them to.
In that case, I still have to come back and ask again. Your story this morning says that the American intelligence agencies determined years ago that A.Q. Khan was one of the world's most successful traffickers in nuclear technology. Why wait until 2004 to intervene?
Fascinating question. And the answer is, we need Pakistan, and we may not have had incredibly specific evidence. Let's take those two statements apart. In the we need Pakistan part, in the 1980s, the Reagan administration needed Pakistan because we were fighting or hoping to support the Afghan groups that were fighting the then Soviet Union. In more recent times, of course, we've needed Musharraf in particular to fight al-Qaeda. So it became very important to the administration that while it stopped proliferation, they did not do anything that could destabilize Musharraf.
But if the price for Pakistan's alliance was a global proliferation of nuclear bombs, that's a high price.
That's quite a price. That's quite a price. Now, the administration argues that, in fact, they were pressuring Musharraf consistently, although they admit that they didn't present him the whole intelligence package with a bow on it, as we said in this morning's story, until September or October of last year, when George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, had this sent to Musharraf, and then Richard Armitage, the deputy secretary of state, followed up with a visit and said, so what are you going to do about this? The argument that the administration makes is that you couldn't go to Musharraf with just bits and pieces and dribbles of information, though they did a fair bit of that, because it wouldn't be enough to give him the political juice to take on a national hero like A.Q. Khan, who had, of course, brought Pakistan into the nuclear age.
And so while that dance went on, the proliferation went on as well, a fairly serious legacy. Finally, David, the president's speech yesterday aimed at choking off proliferation. How would it do that, and would it?
Well, the question is, did the president go far enough? What the president argued is that we should rethink the fundamental bargain that the Atoms for Peace program that the Eisenhower administration first put out in the 50s had enshrined, and that is enshrined in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which is now a little over 30 years old. And that bargain is this, that if you are willing to renounce nuclear weapons, then the West is willing to help you build up a nuclear infrastructure for peaceful nuclear use.
Energy, that
is. Atomic energy, right. The problem is that there's a huge loophole in the way the treaty is written, so that if you go along and get this help, and you are, in fact, gathering up nuclear technology, you could at any moment either renounce the treaty, as North Korea has done, and said, that's it, I'm out of the treaty, thanks for your help, here's the door, and by the way, we're going on with our weapons program. Mm-hmm. Or you could do what Iran did, which was secretly use the technology for a second project that appears to have been involved in enriching weapons-grade fuel, though the Iranians deny it. In either case, what you have is a system that aids countries in building up nuclear technology and then using it out of our sight for purposes that we do not want.
So the president's saying you can still have nuclear energy, but you can no longer reprocess the fuel.
What the president wants to say is the only countries that can reprocess the fuel are those that are already successfully up and running reprocessing. That would be some Europeans, the U.S., and Japan, which has a big project like that. The developing nations are likely to say, now, wait a minute. Why is it that just because you got there a few years before we did, we don't have a right to do this? And as signatories of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, they do have a right to reprocess if they open themselves up to full inspection and so forth. So the administration is in the difficult position now of basically having to go renegotiate the treaty. And a lot of places and a lot of people in the U.S. administration don't want to actually enter that process because the preamble to the treaty says there are five acknowledged nuclear powers, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China. And other nations will say, well, while we're reopening the treaty, mm-hmm. why are only you guys allowed to own nuclear weapons?
So President Bush is really breaking open the rule book here for an all-new negotiation. David, what does all of this proliferation say about the IAEA? Does it come out of this looking utterly ineffective? Isn't it supposed to be the international guardian against proliferation?
It is, and it does look ineffective in some areas, but the IAEA would argue that, in fact, its hands have been tied by both agreements that do not allow it to inspect as fully as it needs to. I think the IAEA's entire budget for safeguards, which is to say the system that watches over how countries use their nuclear materials around the world, is about one-tenth of what we budgeted to go look for WMD in Iraq alone, the worldwide budget.
And on that, the global safety is supposed to hang. Is the genie of nuclear weapons out of the bottle with this? Is it retrievable at this point, whatever President Bush may say, if designs for nuclear weapons are floating around the world in Islamabad dry-cleaning bags, can you get those back?
I think that the design stuff is all out of the bottle. I mean, because there's a lot of basic information that's always been widely available and is now more widely available with the Internet. What's still very hard, Tom, is producing fissile material that's of bomb grade.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the president is rightly concentrating. The question is he doing it hard enough and fast enough and urgently enough?
The senator, Sam Nunn, is quoted saying, the president says terrorists are racing ahead, but we are walking, that the United States is not putting enough resources into clamping down on this either.
Well, Sam Nunn made the good point that one of the president's proposals yesterday is to extend the Nunn-Lugar legislation, which, of course, he was a co-author of, which helps us find more profitable work for former scientists from the former Soviet state
mm-hmm.
who worked on nuclear issues and keep them well employed. The president wants to expand that to Iraqi scientists, Libyan scientists, all that. He didn't announce any new money to do that. And a lot of people believe that we're not spending enough and fast enough, even in the former Soviet states, much less beyond.
And meanwhile, Dr. A.Q. Khan sits in Pakistan, pardoned. The proliferation has happened. It's done.
It's done, and we're not sure that the entire network's rolled up.
What a picture. David Sanger, thanks for all your reporting, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
David Sanger is White House correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoke. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.